And this is the thesis on the jaws, defeat from the jaws of victory notion. But that was the meaning of the Paris agreements. That the Vietnamese in Hanoi went to Paris, they signed the agreement over the objections of the hardliners, and because of a consensus agreement that had been worked out between the two earlier, that if the 72 Easter offensive didn't succeed, that they would take this Paris agreement, this fight-fight, talk-talk route, as a means of, as a new means of achieving their objective of unification. All right, now, the continued maintenance of this balance of power in Hanoi, in this continued pursuit of the soft-line strategy, soft-line doctrine in order to achieve unification, depended on the credibility of the American enforcement of the agreements. The softliner, or the dove argument, was that if the agreements are broken, if you resume big unit war in the South, the B-52s will come back. But when it became apparent with Watergate that an American president had become impotent and was unable to send back the B-52s, the hardliners were then able to get Politburo approval for this one last hurrah to achieve unification. But, and this way this argument concludes then, authorization would never have been granted had American credibility been maintained. There never would have been this last hurrah. The war would have faded. And the victory originally achieved simply would have been sustained. Now, this does not argue that this was anything like capitulation on the part of Hanoi, that they still wanted to achieve unification, but that the predominant thinking in Hanoi was, we can achieve this by other, less costly ways. We do not have to do it toe-to-toe slugging match as we have been doing it. All we've got to do is take off the pressure, and South Vietnam will then begin to come apart at the seams. They don't have what it takes down there to hold their, to get their act together and hold it there. That was the argument. Well, of course, it was a moot point whether this was right or not. We'll never know now. But this is the conclusion. This thesis is the one that Kissinger advances in all of his writings, and it's most forcefully put forth. If you want an example of how it's well stated, is in William Colby's Lost Victory, which was published a few months ago. Colby was a CIA chief in Vietnam. He ran the pacification program. And he makes about as strong a case for this as I think anybody can make. Now, this is not, I would say, simply a perception. This is a historical interpretation that you can't just brush off, as I brush off a lot of things, saying, well, that's just one person's perception or opinion of what happened, because there is historical data there. It doesn't necessarily mean this is the historical truth, but we've reached the point now where I think we can begin to sort out some of the perceptions and say that these are more than perceptions, they are possible historical interpretations. What was present in the North was the determination. You can argue over how this came about, how it was mobilized, what mobilization methods were used, but the inarguable fact that there was a determination in Hanoi, a sense of will. As I say, why this is exactly, it can be and will be variously explained, but you can't just say, well, I think I saw that. That is a perception, not a, it's more than a perception. What was lacking in the South, what proved to be the fatal flaw, was self-confidence. That's sort of the other side of the willpower, will determination. And that is, in turn, a product of a long and complex Vietnamese sense of relations with foreigners. It's what's called Doc Lop, or independence. Doc Lop is a very complicated concept of the proper relationship of an individual to a foreigner. or an individual, or a country to another country. It does not just mean desire for self-determination. It is not just simply anti-colonialism, anti-nationalistic, xenophobic hatred of foreigners, but it's a kind of desire, profound desire, or sense of a need for ties with foreigners, while at the same time a sense that you can't trust foreigners, that they will betray you, so you need this, but you can't have it. That's the context, connotation, I'd say, of Duck Lap. This will become clear, I think, as I go on. South Vietnamese, I think, leader and follower alike, did not really believe in, near the end of the war, say in 1973, did not believe that they could stand alone against the Vietnamese communists. They seldom articulated this, I think, even to themselves, but I think it was ever present there in the consciousness. So this is the second basic historical thesis, more than a perception, something of an assessment of why the Vietnam War turned out the way it did. It has to do, I mean, you can label it a socio-psychological thesis. And the whole notion of armed political Dao Chan as a strategy used against South Vietnam forces the historian to evaluate this in terms of equivalent terms, that is, in terms of the social dynamics, the social psychology in South Vietnam. And this thesis, the person I owe most to for it is Dean Thuc, who is the Faculty of Letters in Saigon, now lives in Paris, and has never written much about it, but I've talked to him over the years about this, and I wish someone would write this as an explanation. You could almost do a book on it. But anyway, the Thuc thesis, and to use just a handle on it, it isn't just him, is that the central reason, the single most important reason of why the Vietnam War ended the way it did, lies within the Vietnamese psyche. The answer lies with the Vietnamese, he would argue, not the Americans, not the other allies. And it can be found, therefore, and historians will find it eventually by exploring the social psychology of Vietnam on both sides, that is, North and South Vietnam. What you explore in the North is the psychological meaning of Dao Chan, armed and political Dao Chan, and you explore it in South Vietnam in terms of social dynamics and social psychology. Do you know what social dynamics is? I mean, the concept? Any of you worked on this at all? Well, it's a sort of branch of social psychology that believes that there are a series of forces and influences within a society that are dynamic, and they are what cause the society to be what it is. And there's a whole range of these. In this case, there are certain ones with respect to North Vietnam, South Vietnam, that are relevant. Now, in one level, really, this is a kind of commonplace matter. That is, all wars are a test of willpower, and they're a test of determination. And these are largely psychological in nature. They have to do with the spirit, with esprit de corps. But I think we're talking about something here that is deeper. It is because it's not based on objective evaluation, but has a kind of cultural and historical heritage. That is, the spirit, the esprit de corps, the degree of optimism that exists within a society about something at any one time, is largely a product of what's going on at that moment. And people are optimistic or pessimistic, happy or sad over contemporary events. This is not something that is 500 years standing, not a 500 year influence and source of historical pressure. That's what I'm talking about here, is this kind of orientation and evaluation which is cultural in nature, which they do inherit in the cultural sense, is a heritage. All Vietnamese, North and South alike, have a kind of psychic need for a sustenance of an alliance. That is, they have a sense of a need to have an alliance, to have a closer relationship. They also have a fear of it. This is the Doc Lop concept. There's a sense of dependency that's present, and along with an unwillingness to rely on this. And it exists much more than you find in other Asian societies. Particularly in Hanoi, was seen as an endemic weakness by Ho Chi Minh, and as a weakness in the Vietnamese character. And he was constantly railing against it, and the agitprop cadres and the Kim Tao's criticism sessions were, for 30 years, were dominated by a need to address this sense, this psychic sense of dependency. It's a kind of a schizoid attitude that's both social and personal, and it's rooted in the Vietnamese heritage. Every Vietnamese knows that his country's history is intimately bound up with its neighbors, chiefly China, but also that this is a history full of duplicity, of betrayal, and defeat. There is, in political sense, there's a kind of umbilical cord that went out from every major political movement in Vietnam in this century. From the, they had this kind of psychic connection with outside sources of support. The Vietnam Quoc San Dong with the QDD, the KMT in China, the Dai Viet with the Japanese from 1910 on, the early reformists, political reformers in the Viet Minh era with the French left, with the Zim and those who came later with the Americans, the Buddhists, movements with the Buddhist activists in Sri Lanka, Viet Minh, and then Hanoi leaders with these three brands of communism, Stalinism, Trotskyism, and a local indigenous. All of these had a kind of outside sense of sustenance and support. Ho Chi Minh spent 50 years abroad trying to get somebody to generate a revolution that would deliver his country. Begun with Sun Yat-sen, he bearded Wilson at the League of Nations, Versailles Treaty in 1919. He went around the world trying to get someone to help deliver his country to him. Very common characteristic of that sort of Vietnamese revolutionary spirit. Now, in other revolutionary movements, say the Congress Party in India, there was a sense among Nehru and Gandhi and so on that they had some friends in London who might do them some good, but there was never any doubt in their mind that this change is going to take place here in India by us, and if we don't do it, it's not going to get done. And you can find that characteristic pretty much throughout all revolutionary movements, anti-colonial movements. In the Vietnamese case, it was quite different. So it was this desperate desire not to avoid taking the responsibility for doing it, but the sense that we Vietnamese cannot do it ourselves, we have got to have outside support. And not material support so much in terms of psychic support. In the case of the way that this sort of ended, the American leaders and the Americans in Vietnam constantly assured the South Vietnamese that we were determined to stand with them. And even if troops were withdrawn, we argued in 1973 as a political necessity, American moral support would continue, American material aid would continue. Now, actually, in terms of objective balance of forces, if you line up the firepower and the armies and the ability to throw lead, North and South Vietnam, they were, South Vietnam was more than equal. They did not have quite as many long-range artillery pieces, 130 millimeter, not as, quite as many tanks, but they had air power, and the North did not have air power. They had more men than the North had, and they were fighting on their own ground, which is a big advantage in terms of. So on an objective balance of forces basis, not only were they equal, but the Vietnamese and South Vietnamese themselves were telling us this same thing. They were saying that, yes, you Americans have carried us long enough. No, it is time for us to, this was 1973 after Paris, to take on the responsibility of, and we can do it and will do it and so on. But it didn't happen. And I think the reason it didn't happen was that the way this really came to me, I had talked about this when I saw him a number of times. We'd have evening sessions. I think where it really came to me was in right at the end in Vietnam when I was back then. This was in March, April of 1975. I was back in Washington. It's a homely example. It was one of these bright lights that suddenly went on, and I said, now I understand. We're living in Northwest Washington, in Cleveland Park, in one of these old, big old houses, with a sort of slow-moving street and an alley behind it. And my son, Andrew, has gotten himself a bicycle, and he wants me to teach him how to ride a bicycle. So the way you teach somebody to ride a bicycle is to get them on a bicycle and then hold this saddle as they pedal up and down this alley, back and forth. And we did this for about 3 nights. And after a while, he got pretty good. He could go quite fast, and I would have to run quite fast to keep up with him, down the alley, back up. And all the time you say, now you've got to hang on, because if you do not hang on to that saddle, I will fall off. And I'd say, okay, I'll hang on. So he'd look around, he'd say, are you hanging on? Yes, I'm hanging on. So up and down we went. And then after a while, I began to hold my hand just back, you know. And he's saying, are you hanging on? And I said, yes, I'm hanging on. And I pretended that I was hanging on. And he was doing fine. And then he turned around, and suddenly at this one time saw that I wasn't actually hanging on. And he fell over. And I said, now, you know, actually, I wasn't holding on. We went up and down twice, and I was never touching that saddle any time. And yet you were doing very well. So it's just in your mind, you think you can't ride this bicycle unless I'm hanging on, but you can. I can tell you did. You went down and back. He said, no, I can't unless you hang on to the saddle. And so eventually, thank God, he finally got enough confidence. But that was that moment of truth when I saw this as an analogy, that the Americans had been supporting the Vietnamese as other political movements, institutions had been supporting the Vietnamese all through the years. And in their mind, there was a belief that we cannot make this alone. That if they would tell the Americans, yes, we can now do this ourselves, but every mother, son of them among themselves didn't really believe this. And so when the first test came at Phuc Thanh and then again at Ban Ma Thuot in early 75, the Vietnamese army, which had stood and fought under far worse conditions, didn't stand and fight at all. And the explanation for this, according to this thesis certainly, is that in their inner hearts they did not believe that they could do it alone. And they were telling themselves that they could. They would look at the order of battle charts and look at the objective balance of forces and say, yes, we are, but in their heart of hearts, not one mother, son of them believed this. So the first test that this came, Arvin just cut, broke. And soon they were unable to stand and fight, even if they wanted to. All right, well, I think this is still a thesis. I don't think you can argue this as a fact, but I think that when the truth or the final assessment of the Vietnam War is produced, the heart of the explanation of what happened there at the end will lie essentially in this explanation, this psychic connection, this sense of dependency that Vietnamese believe you have to have this, and if it's cut, then you just wither and die, like an umbilical cord. It's a good analogy, a good metaphor. You simply have to have it, and there's no way that you can survive without it. And this would be the explanation for what's happened in Vietnam since the war. They have not been able to establish any kind of a sense of an umbilical cord, if you will, with an outside source, not with China, not with the Soviet Union, and that's why it is the life has gone downhill. And presumably, until there can be some kind of reestablishment of some kind of umbilical cord sense of sustenance, it will not improve. This could be an argument, of course, for resumption of U.S.-Vietnamese relations. It would certainly would be, you would think, in the Vietnamese mind. The one hope is to try to reestablish this kind. Now the point is that this is not a conscious thought so much as it's a subliminal thought. I mean, Vietnamese do not go around thinking in these terms, but it's there, that sense of need, that sense of dependency, which they don't really like and don't really want and don't really acknowledge, but nevertheless it's there. All right, that's a little esoteric. Is that clear? Any problem anybody have in understanding? Yes.
I have a question about the problem of dependency. It seems to me like all the examples of dependency. So
that's right. And if anything, the history of Vietnam is you're quite right. If anything, the long history of Vietnam is a history of going it alone. you can establish almost a counter case that the Vietnamese have never had a successful alliance with anybody. Not with the 15th century Burmese, not with the Chinese, not with the Americans, not with the French, not with the Khmer, not with the Thais. That in every one of these cases there have been temporary alignments and alliances, if you will, but that any kind of an association, I mean, this is what Vietnamese history, certainly before this century, very clearly demonstrates, that any kind of an association of the Vietnamese with any foreigner has the seeds of its own destruction in it, and that it will destroy itself. I mean, that's a historical fact, that the Vietnamese relations through the years Vietnam has been much more of a loner historically than almost any other country you can think of. That's probably, though, is the reason why there is this psychic pressure, this sense of need for that kind of a dependency, a sense of it. I find this is character, I don't, you know, want to get too far into psychoanalysis, but I find this is a characteristic of Vietnamese friends of mine, and I have lots of them, and close friends. They want a sort of close relationship, and yet they don't really trust you. They fear the effects of a close relationship. And you find this among Vietnamese themselves, above the Ho or the clan. This does not apply to family relations or blood relations at all, but it applies at a level above. The desire to have this close relationship, but the fear of what this close relationship can do, can mean, and can become. You want to write a paper, that's what you ought to do, your term. There are lots of Vietnamese who have discussed this idea and have wrestled with it, but there's been very little written on it, and particularly written in terms of a transcultural explanation so that non-Vietnamese can understand it. Yes.
If you walked up
No, I don't know. It depends. Well, I think we'd know what the words mean. But, you know, these are abstract intellectual concepts, which are usually only used by a college professor. And, although, like the concepts of Dao Chan, for example, every Viet Cong recruit had this drilled into him, what it was, but it comes out as a series of slogans. He may not really understand it. Any other? Well, I guess I haven't gotten too far on this. The third, I guess it's the fourth. Yeah, well, having dumped on the Vietnamese in this third one, the next one, Invincible Ignorance, I will dump on the Americans. But I don't think there's any point, we don't have much time to start in on this. This is also a little complicated, although some of it will be going over ground that you have heard before. Let me say just a bit about this schematic, because I'm not going to really do too much on this, but if you're trying to reduce something as complicated and amorphous and messy as the Vietnam War, try to reduce this to some sort of systematic way of analysis. I've found that the schematics in general are pretty good devices, and this is a particularly good one. And the idea of this is fairly simple. If you want to assess the Vietnam War in general or any one part of it, if you want to look at one side in the war or the other, or both sides together, you can use this this schematic. What you look at basically are the sides of the triangle. That is, you look at strategy, look at spirit, and you look at organization. What was the spirit that existed on one side or the other? What was the organizational structure, both civilian and military? And what was the strategy that was implied? Now, the point that these come together, that is, the point where spirit and organization meet, so the finite activity is mobilization. And the point where strategy and spirit meet is motivation, and the point where strategy and organization meet is leadership. Those are the more finite. The leadership, in effect, then is concerned with strategy and organization. The mobilizational effort is concerned with both spirit and with organization, and the motivational effort, the persuasive efforts, are obviously a function of the spirit and strategy. These three, then, are defined down below. So you can take you can take any aspect of the war that you want and just ask yourself, then, what was the operative character of the spirit at this time? What was the organizational structure? What was the strategy? You can compare the two sides. Compare the spirit on one side with the spirit on the other, the organizational construct on the two sides, and the strategy used by the two sides. You can also look at the leadership on the two sides, the mobilizational efforts, how did they mobilize the society, not just in persuasive terms, but in terms of resources, in terms of manpower, and so on. And then motivation, how did they motivate? What were the devices used? Are they successful or not? It's a way of reducing to kind of hard terms what is otherwise just an amorphous bog that you're wandering around in trying to get some kind of a handle on. All right, are there any questions on this? Any? Is this clear what this thing is and how you can use it? Anybody have any problems with this? Okay, well, next week then, or next Thursday, we will continue on with the judgments and tentative conclusions.
Are you going to be on TV this Thursday?
No, I'm not. As I was saying, they called me and invited me to come to New York to participate, to be in the audience, if I wanted to pay my own way.
I think you should be there, you know, it's very valuable to you.
Well,
know,
yeah, to. But I hate television and this sort of thing. I've had a couple of people in Washington call me and say the same thing. But then I say, are you going to be there? No, I'm not going to go. So. It'll be a circus. I was surprised that they told me that Kissinger was going to be on there, but a guy told me today that he is backing off from it. So I don't know.
Is it true that the major obstacle for, you know, normalized relations with Vietnam is Kissinger? It's because of Kissinger that he doesn't want relations with Vietnam?
No, I've heard that. I don't think Kissinger is for it, but I don't think he has. He doesn't have that kind of power. The reason is, in my opinion, is twofold. I'm not sure Hanoi wants it right now. They've got other problems. But the basic reason is Newton's second law of physics, that bodies at rest tend to remain at rest. And you've got this body at rest in Washington. We don't have diplomatic relations. In order to get them, you'd have to get this and put some. And there's nobody there in Washington that really wants to do this. Nobody really is stopping it either. Particularly, I don't think anybody. Few people would like to do it. Few people do not like to do it. But overwhelmingly, most people don't care one way or the other. So there it is at rest. And unless you give it a shot, you can't get anything done in Washington unless you get everybody pushing. A lot of people pushing. If nobody is pushing, then nothing happens. First law of bureaucracy. You're against diplomatic recognition, I presume.
I'm not.
You're not?
I'm for.
Most, are you?
I'm for.
You got to watch out for those paratroopers from San Jose, don't you?
Well,
gonna come
no,
after
I think,
you?
I think the majority.
Huh?
The final date for the paper.
Whenever it says on the instructions, 22nd, I think it is, isn't it? Remember?
I'm not sure. Is it
the
last week of class?
The reader has I think it said the last day of, or on the day of the final. The history department says that's not good enough and it's got to be in advance. And you didn't get a thing on the term paper?
I need one. That's
yeah, well, call me at the office and I'll mail you one if you don't have it. Or drop by if you want.
Do you have one of your class syllabuses? I lost your number.
You have one or what? Just call or come down, and whatever you want, I'll mail to you.
All right.
I had a question concerning, you were talking about Zim as a charismatic character.
Yeah.
Were you arguing that he was a poor choice for a charismatic character, or he was
he was charismatic in the sense that Sukarno was, or Mike Sisal, he wasn't maybe quite as charismatic, but he was a dynamic figure. But he turned the Vietnamese off on the idea. They did not want a charismatic.
Because that was, I'm doing.
Well, they just thought it was, you know, that he wasn't what they. I'm not saying this is correct. But I'm just saying